dangling to read chapter 3 of Duncan's War. So here I go. But sputtering came from a candle melting into a mound of yellow tallow on the table. Lights played on the shadows against the walls. From the ear of the peat fire, the shining wheel hummed rhythmically as Duncan's mother drew out lengths of new wool yarn and laid it in wide loops over two wooden pegs. Angus lined up the rows of pebbles at her feet. In and around the rows, he made little forests with tufts of wool snatched from his mother's basket. "Oh, I wish I had seen it with my own eye," continued Grier. But the rest, content of he heard it on the very best of the authority, he lowered his voice confidently. "It were the Sabbath morning of the 23rd of July, 1637, when into the very pulpit of St. Giles strutted a popish bishop, all swishing a sacerdotal pomp, bedecked with Babylonian glitter and puffing superstitious finery. Duncan had never been in an Anglican service, but he often wondered just what it would be like. Sometimes he even imagined himself sneaking his way into a service down into the old parsonage kirk and seeing all. It's as bad as all that?" asked Duncan. "Aye, and worse," said Grier. "That day at St. Giles, the usurping bishop, sneering in triumph, read, mind ye, read, popish prayers from the accursed pages of Lord's Liturgy right here in the Presbyterian Scotland." Grier's eyes goggled defiantly. He continued. For an instant, all was silent in the grand old kirk, save the scurrying of rats scavenging for crumbs under the table. Duncan's mother frowned. Duncan's and his sister's eyes grew wide. "Then that's what happened," continued Grier, encouraged by their attention. "A lass named Jenny Gettles. Ye bear a whole name, Jenny." He patted Jenny on the head. "I say, Jenny Pell Geds left." Jenny Geds left to her feet, gathering up her stool, and she cried, "Will you read that book in my lug?" Then, with a mighty heave, she hurled her stool at the bishop, determined not to submit to the lad's nonsense. A hot-blooded congregation joined in a frenzy of displeasure. Soon, fiery-tempered Presbyterians clogged the streets of the Royal Mile. Riots followed, and so hated were Loud's men that one of them, Bishop Birkin, kept a brace of loaded pistols in full view of the pulpit when he ventured to conduct the papist rites. "So that, Jenny, she'd be a hero, aye, she would," said Jenny, smiling. Duncan's mother paused at her spinning and looked sternly at Jenny. "A leaping up and a yelling during services?" said her mother incredulously. "Sounds more like shameful behaving for a lass, under any provocation." "Aye, your mother speaks the truth, Jenny lass," added Duncan's father, looking up from where his great hands had been clasped under his chin. Then he gazed pensively into the smoldering peat. Grier stroked his beard and scowled before continuing. Then came a great marriage day of this nation, with God, the
28th of February, 1638. A grand day it was. Hundreds of faithful ministers, nobles, and gentry gathered at Greyfriars Kirk in Edinburgh, mind ye, in peril of their lives. They put down their names on Alexander Henderson's National Covenant. The stoutest of heart put their names down with their own blood. Was it a rebellion? Asked Duncan eagerly. If ye go to pledge your support to the king, said Grier, does that sound like a rebellion, lad? No, said Duncan, a hint of disappointment in his voice. Well, mind ye, they pledged loyalty to King Charles in all matters belonging to King Charles. At the same stroke, they pledged loyalty to King Jesus at all matters of pertaining to King Jesus. Make no mistake about it, we Scots are no king haters. We just see more than one of them. And King Charles I demanded a loyalty which the faithful give to God alone. Prepared to resist or die, thousands more signed the covenant over the next weeks. I among them. Did ye do it with your blood? Blood? Asked Jenny, grinning hopefully.
Aye, I did, said Grier, nodding grimly. That I did. Did ye sign, father? Asked Duncan. Your father was just a wee thing in those days, explained Grier before Duncan's father could reply. Fiona looped her arm around her father's, closed her eyes, and leaned against his strong shoulder. He ever pledged my highest loyalty to King Jesus and his kirk, replied Duncan's father, stroking Fiona's head. I will, the saints and martyrs who've gone before us, I'd willingly give my life's blood to defend, mind ye, I say to defend kirk and covenant.
Your loyalty, none doubt, said Grier, eager to return his story. Meanwhile, from all about that realm, faithful Scots relied to defend, mind ye, Sandy, to defend the cause of religion and covenant. Even the Earl of Arlger threw in his lot with us. Did we kill them all? Asked Jenny. Lass, I'll not have ye gloated over the death of the wicked, said Duncan's father firmly. No wicked blood split this time anyhow, said Grier with a dismissive wave of his hand. The king's troops faced off with so south-hearted Covenanter army, and King Charles backed down without a fight. Grier chuckled and stroked his beard, but fearing the growing pressure of Puritans in the English Parliament, Charles visited Scotland and gave out rank, tittle, and gold to all lairds who throw their lot with him. Ouch, said Duncan, holding his head with his hands. So whose side are we on, and who was on our side? Aye, that's the question indeed, my lad, said Duncan's father approvingly. We are ever on the side of King Jesus, and ever loyal are we to the king or to the parliament that acknowledges the crown rights of the Redeemer in his kirk. So did the lairds of Scotland throw in Charles of the kirk? Asked Duncan. The faithful, like Earl Ger, remained true to the covenant, said Grier. They were determined to support either king in the parliament, whichever promised freedom to worship the kirk. Worthy Samuel Rutherford and the Scots commissioners to Westminster negotiated with the Parliament, and with the signing of the Solemn League and Covenant in 1643, Parliament agreed to the Presbyterian government in the Kirk in exchange for Scottish troops to fight civil war against Charles. Grier's eyes narrowed. He spread his eyes wide for effect, light from the fire and candles casting a looming shadow of the old man against the rough walls. "That's where I come into the fight." And with a wee bit of assistance from Cromwell, we Scots brought Charles to his knees at Marston Moor. A bloody fight we had in that day. Meanwhile, the Scots betrayer, the Popish Montrose, raised a Highlander support for Charles, and in 1645 rooted all Covenanters out of the Argyll lands. Here, Duncan's father raised his gaze from the fire and looked at the children. Steady breathing came from a mound on the floor where Angus lay asleep. "Your father fled infirmary and mortals in those times," said their father, "and brought us here to the lowlands. I was a wee bit younger than ye, Duncan, in those days." "What was it like, father?" said Duncan. His father gazed slightly into the fire before answering. "A smoke and fire of a reek a-burning, he said, a far-off look in his eyes, and the thunder of a cannon and the whistling of the bullets, and some wailing of the bearings. He fell silent before continuing. "I remember hiding in the heather all day and traveling at night, bone weary, asleep on my feet while slogging along in with your Uncle Hamish a-drooling on my back." Jenny drew her head back and laughed. Fiona looked up pityingly at her father. "But Uncle Hamish as big as ye, father," said Jenny. "He's too big for ye to be carrying." "So I thought," replied their father. "But he was just a wee thing then." "What else?" urged Duncan. "I remember being hungry. Hungry all the time." "Aye, that's bad," said Duncan soberly. Grier picked up the story. "With that fellow Cromwell backing us, we Scots routed the Royalists of June in 1645 at Naseby. Charles surrendered to the Scots troops, but he refused to give up his grand notions of ruling the Kirk by what he determined his divine right. So we turned him over to the Parliament after he promised not to kill him." "Why not be rid of him?" asked Duncan. Duncan's father scowled. "Aye," replied Grier with a pull on his beard. "There is a question indeed, lad." Little did we ken that we were seeking to preserve the very royalty that now sets about to destroy us. But things got worse on our side. Cromwell, strutting with borrowed glories, began waning in his promise to keep the solemn league of the covenant. What's more, he and the Parliament and the assembled ministers of Westminster were not getting on so well. "That's the English for ye," said Duncan. Can't even get along with your own kind." "And we can," said Duncan's father fiercely. "We Scots have killed more Scots than any of our enemies ever needed to." "Aye, Charles played on our disagreements," adding Grier. "Watching all and desperate to get free of prison, Charles entered into a secret agreement with some Covenanters, vying to allow Presbyterian government in the Kirk." "Was the king lying then?" Fiona said incredulously. "Aye," said Duncan bitterly. "Lying and using our side to get him free from Cromwell. And the solemn league of the covenant, now seen by many Scots as broken by the Parliament and Cromwell," continued Grier. "Some of our set out on a plot to free Charles. Cromwell, now the enemy of Scotland, met them at Preston. Them? Said Duncan. Weren't ye fighting with them, Ancient Friar?
No.
I was home, nursing a wound from Nasberry fighting. He patted his left knee. I would never stop saying so myself, but other of my fighting lads said the whole campaign might have come out different if I had been there. But I weren't. But I weren't. And in 1648, Cromwell routed our Scots army. Poor lads. The next year, he marched on Edinburgh.
What happened to the king? Asked Fiona, her voice coming softly from the shadows.
Parliament's lie, too, Briar spat out. The English Parliament betrayed its word given to Scotland and executed Charles the First. Lifted his head right off, they did. And now whose side were we on? Asked Duncan, scowling in confusion. That's the question indeed, said Grier, nodding gravely. One thing is clear. The Parliament had broken the covenant and no longer to be trusted. So the Marquis of Arkill negotiated with Charles's son, the rightful heir, who signed the National Covenant and promised the Kirk to her rights. With his own hands, godly Arkill placed the crown on the head of Charles Stuart, later Charles II, our present dissembling monarch. But Cromwell would have none of this rebellion.
Rebellion? Said Duncan. How could it be rebellion? We were now the ones supporting the king?
Aye, the question ignored by the likes of Cromwell, replied Grier, making a more violent yank at his beard. Now calling himself Lord Protector, Cromwell and his roundheads marched against at Dunbar, finally crushing the Scots army at Worcester in 1651. From the safety of the spire of Worcester Cathedral, Charles watched our lads die on the battlefield below. Aye, the River Stern ran red with Covenanter blood that day. He took to his heels, leaving the beleaguered remnant of his army to fend for themselves.
So that's what we got for being loyal, is it? Said Duncan, a bitter wit in his voice.
Ah, but Duncan, said his father, there's one king who'll never betray his subjects. Though loyalty in our Redeemer puts us at the odds with his kings and parliaments, and it is the cause of our present woe, King Jesus will never betray ye for your loyalty to him. And in his time, a day of reckoning awaits our enemies, so says the book. Heavy breathing rose from where Jenny and Angus lay, sprawled in a sheepskin at their mother's feet. Duncan's father rose and gathered the now sleeping Fiona up in his great arms and gently laid her on her chaff-filled mattress. He covered her and placed a kiss tenderly on her forehead. Hasten the day of that reckoning, continued Grier, smashing his fist into his palm of his hand savagely. Angus snorted in his sleep and rolled over. I'll be asking ye to keep still, Ancient Grier, said Duncan's mother, lest ye wake the wee ones. My regrets to the bairns, he said. But there's more than my blusterings like to be disturbing their rest with Charles II ruling the land of the Kirk. Have ye forgotten what our dissembling monarch did when he was restored to his throne?
"Foul betrayer of the covenant," he spat the words. He declared the loyal Marquis of A. Algirl a traitor and ordered his execution. His eyes grew wide and goggled at them as he drew his forefinger sharply across the neck with a click, click. "But why the Marquis of the Argyll?" asked Duncan. "He was the very one who places the crown on Charles' head." "Why indeed," said Guy hotly. "Argyll was the only that the first of many saints to die." Here Grial looked sternly at Duncan's father, "and thousands more will die unless Charles be resisted." Duncan's father looked steadily back at the old man, their eyes locked for a moment. "You know the rest," continued Grier. "Our truest ministers ejected from their pulpits, and Charles' favorites, popish drunkards, propped up in their places to lead the Kirk astray. Rule taken at the episcopal services, fines levied for nature to attend, for failure to attend, and faithful hunted down like criminals, field meetings raided by dragoons, threats, beatings, and brandings, prison, even men even killed before the very eyes of their wives and bearings. The humming of the spinning wheel stopped short. Duncan's mother raised her head from her wool. "Has it come to that?" she said, fierceness in her eyes. "Aye, and worse," said Grier. "With James Turner, unprincipled Mershiny butcher, leading his band of evildoers about the court side, none are safe, not even we who eke our living far up the hills." Grier paused, eyeing the stock of the barrel of the family and musket hanging in the neat wall near the door. "Peace-loving man that ye be, Sandy McKeith," said Grier, "come not on the Sabbath to a field meeting in the glen without your sword at your hip and your gun loaded at the ready." Duncan watched as candlelight played on the stout blade of his father's claymore, hung over the fireplace. His father clenched his rough hands together until his knuckles shone white. The Lord knows I'll not kill a man, no matter how evil, in cold blood," Duncan's father said, his voice steady and resolved. "Nor will I be standing idle while a wicked man kills another in cold blood. But I'll not be looking for a fight. I'm the opinion that some of our suffering will bring on ourselves with our own hot blood. Perhaps that's another kind of betrayal in any case, ancient Grier. True as I am to the covenant, I'll not go with my heart's yearning to worship the Prince of Peace while my hands are clutching eager at my blade. I respect ye for your reluctance to shed blood, Sandy," said Grier, nodding differently. "But if you'll not fight," he spread his arms in a shadowy supplication, "I hope you can scatter the mist to find a good place for your hiding, your dear ones. Come harvest time, when ye think your crops are safe in, Turner and his dragoons descended on ye like a death angel, plaguing King Charles and his London. And then may the Lord have mercy and your street bearings." So that was chapter 3. Bye, guys. See you later. See you later. See you later. See ya. See ya later. Bye, guys.